This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. The full name of this radio program is Entitled Opinions About Life and Literature. The little word "and" is not nearly as innocent as it sounds. Where and how do life and literature conjoin? Where and how do they disjoin? Keep in mind that life here means more than its biological incarnations. It also means history and all the tragedies that leer at us whenever we open a newspaper. What are newspapers ultimately, if not the chronicles of human misfortune? Many of those misfortunes are directly related to the fortunes made by those who can afford to buy the luxury items and precious jewels featured in the full-page ads of our major newspapers, alongside stories of unspeakable misery and degradation. All this to say that our topic today on Entitled Opinions is life, literature, and tragedy, especially as they converge in post-colonial literature. My guest, Ato Kwesen, is eminently entitled to his opinions on the matter, having recently published a book called Tragedy and Post-Colonial Literature, Cambridge University Press, 2021. Ato Kwesen is the author and editor of many other books as well, including Aesthetic Nervousness, Disability, and the Crisis of Representation. He is the Jean and Morris Doyle Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies and Professor of English at Stanford, where he also chairs the Department of African and African American Studies. He is a fellow member of the Academy of Arts and Sciences of America and was the past president of the African Studies Association. Ato Kwesen, welcome to Entitled Opinions.
Thank you so much, Robert.
I'd like to begin by taking you back to a day in November 1995 when you learned that the Nigerian writer and activist Ken Saro-Wiwa, along with eight of his colleagues, had been hanged. You had recently joined the faculty at Cambridge University and had just started teaching the university's tragedy course for undergraduates. You write that you paced up and down your office deeply upset, by turns, shaking your fists in the air and holding your head in your hands. The death of Saro-Wiwa clearly had a visceral impact on you, and by your own admission, incubated the book we'll be discussing today, Tragedy and Postcolonial Literature. Could you begin by reminding our listeners of who Saro-Wiwa was, and then say maybe a few words about how the news of his hanging led you to explore the connection between tragedy and post-colonial literature?
So, Saro-Wiwa was a Nigerian writer, and oddly enough, he wrote what would be considered comedies. You know, so he had television shows, Bassey and Company, and also he had one of his most famous novels was Sousa Boy, the subtitle, A Novel in Rotten English. And basically, the English was a kind of pidgin English. It's very, very funny. But he also happened to be an environmental activist for the Ogoni people of Eastern Nigeria. Now, Eastern Nigeria is better known for the Igbo people, especially made popular by Chinua Achebe in his novels, Things Fall Apart, Arrow of God, and various others. The Ogoni are not that well known. They are a micro-minority, except that they occupy very important oil-bearing lands. And Saro-Wiwa had been advocating very vehemently to stop, at the time, Shell was the main culprit, but there were other oil companies, from polluting the land. So basically, it was in the very early days of environmental activism, and the Nigerian government, led by Sani Abacha, arrested them, arrested him and the leaders of the what they call the MOSOP movement for the Ogoni peoples, and hanged them. There was no trial or anything. They were hanged.
There were no indictments.
Nothing. They were just arrested, detained, and hanged peremptorily. And this was a very, for me personally, it was very shocking, A, because he was a writer, and B, because I had just started teaching this big paper on tragedy. And the paper on tragedy is big for two reasons. One, it's a mandatory paper for all people, all students reading the English literature. And it was big also because it spanned all of tragic expressions from the Greeks to current times. So it was big in both respects. And I had been teaching it, you know, to the best of my ability. At the time, I didn't know as much about tragedy as I do now. But I was enjoying myself, except that this news brought me to a very hard stop, and which is that literary tragedy, into the tragedy in literature, was nothing if not somehow aligned or used to illuminate the tragedies that were unfolding around us. And in this particular case, most poignantly by an African writer whom I was familiar with and who was not in the tragic canon because he didn't write tragedies. And yet, nothing seemed to me more potent, as tragic as the hanging of Saruwiwa. And so it got me thinking very much, first of all, about what exactly did I think I was doing, you know, teaching tragedy at Cambridge. What might I do? At the time, I was very frustrated. Was there something I could do to push the needle of justice? So I thought about all those things. And then I decided in the end that the best thing I could do was to think of ways of deploying the many insights that I was gathering about tragedy to illuminate, you know, problems in ordinary life.
But you make a distinction between the tragic and the merely sad or bad or even catastrophic. It's that at least the art of tragedy, beginning with the Greeks, it's a story, it's a narrative, and it has certain components that have to do with things like recognition scenes, reversal of fortune, some sort of hamartias, as Aristotle called it, which is an error in judgment. At the end, there's a concatenation of events which lead to a tragic outcome, and there's an effect of catharsis, and, you know, purging of fear and terror. So I think from what I've read in your book, you were trying to say, well, wait a minute, you know, what happens in life and in history, there, it can be very tragic in the sense of sad, bad, and terrible, but the rules of literary tragedy, you know, are a little bit different. And the challenge for you was to kind of make one come together with the other.
Yes. Now, the first thing that I worried about was that the history of interpretations of tragedy focused predominantly, obviously, on literature, but to start with, on the theater, on drama. So all the many, you know, things in theater, starting from the Greeks, Shakespeare, and so on, were very much at the core of discussions of tragedy. The second thing is that the word tragedy is not the same as, in ordinary parlance, if you read in a newspaper, oh, the bombing of Iran, for example, is tragic. They mean bad or sad, you know. Yes. In tragic theory, the term tragedy is a technical term. And as you rightly noted, it has certain features, including everything that you mentioned, hamartia and so on and so forth. And not unusually, tragedy is discussed around catastrophes. So multiple deaths at the end, reversal, bad things. But displayed on stage or in the novel or on film in such a way as to, as it were, elevate it to a form of aesthetic expression. So the first challenge was, for me, was to try and show how a tragedy did not occur only in the pages of literature, and that its profound effects were not limited to aesthetic ones. But how would I do that? And I didn't come up with this. This second tributary is already present in the discourse on tragedy, was the question of suffering.
Yeah.
You know, so as opposed to catastrophe, my focus was on suffering. The next challenge was to define suffering. A working definition of suffering that I came to, which I drew on Cicero and some other writers, was that suffering is the experience or imminent threat of the dissolution of integrity, of bodily integrity. So it's not just about moral integrity, but your body itself is being assaulted. Now that leads to suffering, and you can replace suffering with grief, for example. So that leads to grief. So Cicero says, for example, that grief scalds the mind. It burns the mind. It leads to forms of discombobulation and so on and so forth. Once I did that, it was a short step for me now or then to, as it were, itemize the various things that would constitute assaults on the integrity of the self, including some that seem completely banal, like poverty, like lack of healthcare, like the consequences of a bad education and so on. Now, this then served in my mind to democratize the idea of tragedy, because each and all of us have experienced in various levels of degrees of intensity things that are assaults to the self, to the integrity of the self. So that's the first step. The second step was also to show how when these assaults on self-integrity are intense up to a point, they tip over into an idea that Aristotle posits, not in the Poetics, but in the Nicomachean Ethics, where he says that there are impediments to ethical life. And some of the impediments that he lists, so he does list poverty, but the most important of the impediments that he lists is what he describes as the loss of philia. Philia being both familial and friendly mutual bonds of attachment and obligation. In other words, according to, if we took Aristotle on his own terms, if you woke up one fine afternoon and your entire family and friends were lost in a hurricane or by some bombs, for example, for Aristotle, you would not only suffer grief, your capacity to be good would also be impaired.
To act virtuously.
To act virtuously would necessarily be impaired, because the bonds of philia are what actually prop up your moral sense. Yeah. Once I got to that, it was very easy to see a proliferation of conditions of the loss of philia triggering the dissolution of the of self-integrity.
So suffering is, you know, the crucial phenomenon there, but there's also justice, because there are types of suffering which come about that don't necessarily come about because of injustices. And those can be sad, they can be bad, and so forth. But would you say that the kind of criterion for the tragic does involve some sense that either an injustice has been done or justice is working itself out in such a way that the situation, well, it's tragic also because there is some transgression that goes back to a moral human agency, not natural disaster and so forth.
Well, not always. There are many instances where some form of injustice triggers the tragic, you know, the dissolution. Shakespeare is full of them. You know, Hamlet is a great example, Macbeth and so on. But there are also tragedies that derive from what I would call a constriction. You know, a constriction which is does not necessarily pertain to justice or injustice, but pertains to the conditions of everyday life. Yeah. A great example is Hedda Gabler, mm-hmm. Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. Now, as you know, Hedda's constriction is that she feels herself entrapped in marriage to a mediocre man. He's a lovely guy, you know, Jürgen Tessmann is lovely, but she feels herself, you know, tethered to mediocrity. Yep. And so she's extraordinarily irritated, and so she feels trapped. Of course, there are other things, which is the condition of being a woman in that period and being married and not having the right to determine you know, property, you know, control of property and so on and so on. There, it is not injustice at the blatant level of, say, Macbeth or Hamlet. Even when you think of Ophelia in Hamlet, there's a major injustice pertaining to her and so on. So there are conditions where the constriction is, in a way, it is experienced as an existential constriction. It's a constriction out of circumstance. That's what you would say for, say, Beckett. For many of Samuel Beckett's plays, where the constriction is experienced as a threat or assault. And so the character had various other Beckettian characters tries to escape or alleviate the constriction. In the case of Hedda, her mode of alleviation, first of all, she's very cruel. Her responses are so, the way she, for example, treats Aunt Tessman is very harsh. But also she tries to, as it were, activate a mode of heroic action via her former boyfriend, Lovborg. And the activation is in trying to invite him to do something we would now see it as wild. That is to say, to commit suicide with laurels in his hair. That's what she says. You know, something entirely, oh, there's a Greek god whose name, the god of wine.
Dionysian. Yeah.
You know, yeah. So she wants to activate a Dionysian principle, which is completely wild. And so this is a way for her to...
He's a god of tragedy, by the way.
Yes, is he not? Yeah. To elude what is this ridiculous constriction. So there, it's not... I agree with you, the justice theme or injustice as a trigger is commonplace. You find it almost everywhere. But there's also this other thread, which is not about injustice at all, but it's about a constriction.
Constriction.
Yeah, so, existential constriction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When... one reads the title of your book, Tragedy and Postcolonial Literature, I think a lot of us in the West, at least, mm-hmm. think of the concept postcolonial, mm-hmm. which has within it the history of colonialism.
Yes.
That's where the substantial, almost self-evident connection between the tragic and the colonial, mm-hmm. where it deals with suffering, constriction.
Definitely.
Injustice. So all these things seem to be present in post-colonial literature. No?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's entirely true. And what I sought to do was to get away from what I consider to be rather weak model of post-colonial criticism, which is basically oppression met by resistance. Yeah. I think that model is overly hydraulic. You know, so oppression, resistance. It's overly hydraulic, and it doesn't actually take account of the complex nature of the. So what I tried to do was to lay out the effects of colonialism, or some of the effects, not all of them, was not just the distortion of communities, colonized communities, but at a personal level, more the ambiguation of attitudes to one's own heroic values, both communal and personal. And it is this ambiguity, the fact that you no longer have certainty, unlike, say, Coriolanus or Oedipus, who thinks that they have certainty about what it is to be heroic. What colonialism did was that it scrambled what it is to be heroic. So many postcolonial characters in postcolonial novels are conflicted about how do I assert even my opposition to colonialism, drawing on the roots or values of my community. Because in many instances, there's a novel by Achebe that I discuss. It's called Arrow of God. The community of Arrow of God cannot agree communally on what is their shared genealogy.
Yeah.
That is to say, how did we as a community get, they can't agree. They can't agree on who are their central gods. They cannot agree. They cannot agree on the value system. What constitutes a father's word? And this is very different from his first novel, Things Fall Apart, where the community is unanimous. So everyone more or less agrees on what constitutes a father's word. What's the status of, if you invoke, my father told me, what does it mean? In Arrow of God, the fact that you said your father, because my father also told me something different. So you have a plethora of contradictions, all of them eating at what might constitute heroic action. And in the midst of this is a heroic figure who thinks himself heroic, who acts heroic, and he's the priest of Ulu. But the priest of Ulu is always angry. And he's always angry because everyone disagrees with him. And this disagreement leads to tragedy because it's a complicated story, but he ends up trying to punish his people by refusing to eat the ritual yam, the tubers of yam that he has to eat ritually up to a point to declare the harvest. And he refuses to eat it because at some point he's invited by the colonial officials and detained. And because he's detained and his people don't send for him, he spends one moon in detention. By missing that moon, he's not able to eat the yam at the appropriate time because he doesn't have them. So he's so annoyed that he wants to punish them by refusing to declare the yam festival. Now, this is terrible because what happens is that the new Christian mission says, bring your yams to Christ. Yeah. Jesus loves you. Bring your yams to Christ and then you can go and harvest. And that breaks his community apart.
So it sounds like one of the great themes, tragic themes across a lot of the post-colonial
world
would be this tragic severance from the past or severance from the traditions or the foundations that gave you certain everyday certainties about the Father's word or what is... who are our gods and what are our modes of behavior? And this disambiguation, as you call it, or
ambiguation.
Yeah. Ambiguation. We know it very much for the Native Americans here in on this continent who have lost so much connection to their traditions and their languages. And it takes great effort to try to recover them, especially when many of the traces and the remnants have been gone. So, would you add dispossession this cultural dispossession to the list
Definitely. There's cultural dispossession. There's the ambiguity also comes because of the effect of, in a word, modernity. Mm-hmm. But modernity doesn't do enough justice. Right. So we need to, as it were, break it down. For example, Christianity. You know, because one thing that Christianity did was that it proffered different forms of meritocracy. So God loves us all. you know. But that meritocracy came to overlay the already existing forms of traditional meritocracy and scrambled them. So that those who were Christianized, this is a very simple example, were split between this Christian meritocracy and the aspirations that it implies in their own traditional meritocratic values. And so, which way do they go, left or right? The other thing is that it led to different kinds of emotional malaise. Mm-hmm. You know, because malaise, ennui, malaise, was also part of modernity because of the changes from tradition to, in a way, part of the sadness is that some people did benefit from modern, obviously. Sure. They benefited from a Western style education. They benefited from all kinds of things. But at the same time, they felt disconnected from their people.
Yeah.
They felt disconnected from their gods. Their gods were demonized and so on. So there's a whole, and that's why I don't like the hydraulic mode, because the hydraulic mode would just dictate that, okay, they should gather up and fight. You know, they should gather. But it's not a straightforward thing, because you are in Things Fall Apart, Achebe. I'm going back to Achebe. There's a point where they have a big discussion about what to do about the insults that the white district commissioner has. And one of the guys speaking at the big meeting says that the problem is that we will have to fight amongst ourselves. Whereas before, we had a clear enemy.
Yeah.
You know, we went out and fought. But now we'll have to fight amongst ourselves, because some of our own people are now part of the district commissioner's court. And so what do we do about this division, self-division? It's all part of the work of colonialism.
Yes, and it's also one of the more diabolical strategies of enlistment, where you can find the way, if you're the colonizer, to divide.
And rule.
Divide and rule, yes. Yeah,
yeah, that's exactly. Yeah.
Mm. So, Ato, some of the other Achebe obviously looms large, mm-hmm. And is extremely well known. You also deal with some other important authors. Mm-hmm. And just for our listeners who would like to get a sense, so there's Tayyib.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yes. So
Tayyib Saleh.
Yeah. He's a type. He's interesting Saleh. Guy.
Very, very.
Yeah, good. Yeah. So there's
Tayyib Saleh, Wole Soyinka.
Soyinka, Toni Morrison. And his tragic theater, especially,
there's,
no?
Yes, and, there's Toni Morrison.
Toni Morrison.
There's Arundhati Roy.
You have Kurtz's Waiting for the Barbarians.
Waiting for the Barbarians, that's, yeah.
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 And the God of all, the God of small things.
Small things, yes. Arundhati Roy, yes.
Yeah, for sure. And we can't obviously discuss all these novels, but it's also quite surprising to find Samuel Beckett in this list of characters, because I of course he was Irish, but he was it's ambiguous. But I was really taken with the chapter on Beckett and the way you analyze Waiting for Godot and the existential condition of waiting for something that doesn't arrive, and this insight into the issuelessness of standing by or waiting, and how you relate it to the
Egyptian,
the migration experience, where and I know in Europe especially, you know, I spent a lot of time in Italy and in France, you have a number of Africans, they are waiting for something to happen. And can you say a little bit more about this connection?
So Beckett, whom as you know from the book, I've written various things on Beckett. Beckett is really fascinating. And the first principle that I got from Beckett was to do with his relationship to disability. Well, many of his texts actually have disabled characters in them. So my first foray into Beckett was the previous book, yes, but actually there's an essay that I wrote that didn't make it into the book on Murphy.
Mm.
I reprised Murphy for Tragedy in Postcolonial Literature, because I think Murphy is an autistic character. Anyway, so let's put that aside. But the next installment of my interest in Beckett was the idea of boredom.
Yeah.
You know, but boredom, I have a formula for boredom. The poor have time, but the rich have leisure. The poor have free time and the rich have leisure. But free time is not the same as freedom. Free time is actually a sign of not being able to convert your free time into wage labor.
Yeah.
You know, so that free time becomes a burden. And
it becomes almost like a waste
of time. It's a waste of time. And all what you want to do, especially for the many unemployed, is to trade your free time for labor time and earn something. So I took this idea of boredom from Beckett. In Beckett's case, Didi and Gogo, Estragon and Vladimir, are not economic beings. Because if they were economic beings, when Pozzo and Lucky entered the stage, they would have sold Estragon's boot. But they don't sell Estragon's boot. They don't. In that play, Beckett is not interested in economics. Otherwise, they should have sold the boot and then made someone. No, what he's interested in is the utter fruitlessness of having to wait for a meaning that keeps getting deferred. And so what that deferral of meaning does, of closure, is that it imposes the necessity to while away the time, which is literally what they do. And they devise all kinds of means to while away the time, including insulting, trading insults. So they trade insults. They do all kinds of things to while away the time because the time is a burden. Waiting is a burden. Now, if you switch to these poor migrants, African migrants who have had to traverse all kinds of dangers to get into Europe and so on, they're also waiting. They're waiting for their refugee. Are they refugees? Yeah. Some of them are not refugees, by the way, but they are claiming refugee status. They are waiting for papers. Yeah. Actually, there's a whole genre of waiting for documentation, waiting for your green card or waiting for your visa and so on.
It's Kafka too.
It's Kafkaesque, thank you. It's also Kafkaesque of waiting for. And of course, these people, some of them have to wait for a very long time because the states that they have entered, you mentioned Italy, Spain, Greece, cannot decide. And they're not in a hurry to decide what status to assign them. And this debate, so the Italian parliament, let us say, or the Greek parliament is debating. The time of debate is the time of waiting for these poor immigrants. And it's also the time of uncertainty because it is quite clear that Europe can no longer take on the burden of these immigrants. Europe does need more immigration, by the way, because of low birth rates. So that's why, for example, Angela Merkel invites 1 million Syrians. She decides to take in, after the collapse of Syria, she immediately takes in 1 million Syrians because Europe, Germany, Italy, they are suffering birth. But they would prefer skilled labor. They would rather have skilled labor than these teeming hordes of unskilled. God knows where they are coming from. This is from the thinking of.
Sure.
So for the immigrants destitute on the beaches or whatever, the period of waiting is burdensome. And it's as burdensome as it was for Estragon and Vladimir because they're waiting for a meaning that keeps getting deferred. It discombobulates the self. It's a mode of suffering. It's a condition of suffering.
Yeah, boredom is also a loss of relations with everything. And in that sense, there's many people, Kierkegaard, Freud, Heidegger, distinguish between boredom and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Anxiety somehow isn't more agitated, and through anxiety you have a certain revelation into maybe
the next steps,
the emptiness of being, or if you want to be Heideggerian. Boredom doesn't even have this sort of insight into a metaphysical principle. It's just this Beckett-like waiting for something not going to arrive.
Or Kafkaesque, yeah.
Yeah, do you think boredom, it's very interesting to think that about the potential tragedy of boredom.
Huh? Well, boredom...
Because boredom is also inaction, and Aristotle, you insist time and again, the essence of tragedy is the imitation of actions of men, no?
Well, it's not just the imitation of action. An action is not just lifting out your arms. Because that's an action. For Aristotle, an action is an ethical, an action as an expression of ethical choice. That's so Hamlet action, Macbeth action, Oedipus action. This boredom is, as it were, it is enervating. It is enervating of action because the actions that you undertake are actions of survival, of making do. They are not necessarily ethically salient in the Aristotelian sense. And so they're corrosive. So boredom is corrosive of action.
Because as you said, it's whiling away the time. Acting in time. It's a kind of waiting for the possibility of action
Which may never come.
Which may never come, right? Yeah. So it is the inability to act in the full ethical sense of action certainly is a tragedy that's lived day in and day out by
a lot
of people. Yeah,
corrosive. And it's corrosive for lots of people. So, of course, we are focusing on these poor immigrants. But there are lots of people waiting in San Francisco, for example, on the streets of San Francisco. They wait, and while they wait, they make do with all kinds of devices to alleviate the waiting and the boredom. And countless other cityscapes all over the world, in New York. I mean, we are talking about San Francisco because it's right next to us. And you can see how the waiting is corrosive. You know, the boredom is corrosive because there's no clear gesture, which is an ethical gesture. We may be overstating the case because they are small ethical gestures, but the gesture because in literature, as you well know, an event is different from a happening. An event is one that has consequences for other events that follow. And so an action would be one that will impact the plot. So they are performing actions, obviously, but it is not impacting the plot of their lives.
Right.
So their actions are weightless gestures, which don't impact the changes that they need the changes that not just impact on their personal lives, but will actually give them the recognition and attention that is required from municipal authorities, for example. So it's abrasive, ultimately.
Do you think the cell phone is one of these drugs or palliatives for boredom? Because when I see many of the people who are disenfranchised and from the point of view of action and that they're living in a condition of boredom, it's this little device in their hands that seems to it's where their boredom. It's not alleviated. Just alleviated, but it's also the form that boredom can take is this endless scrolling and doing and distraction. Well, it's whiling away the time.
About 20 years before the era of the cell phone, if you were waiting for the bus and the bus was delayed, you would light up a cigarette.
Yeah.
You light a cigarette, and that was how you whiled away the time. Yes, and the cigarette, one advantage of the cigarette, you know, was that you could strike up conversations with the cigarette.
Yeah.
You would ask for a lighter, a match, and then you strike up. The cell phone does something similar in that it helps to while away the time while you wait, but it cuts off interaction.
Right.
Its objective is specifically to separate you from sociality.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's nothing that promotes sociality more than cigarettes and a kind of conversation at the bus stop.
Oh,
at,
exactly.
You know, there's also nothing more democratic than a cigarette. In the days when we were all smoking.
Gone are the days.
Yes, gone are the days. But we could ask a fellow smoker, hey, could you spare a cigarette? You know, and you would always give a cigarette to someone.
And you have a chat about it. You know, what make of cigarette, for example. Or you to be nice, you say something about why you don't have cigarettes right now and so on. And that was to start a conversation.
Right. And I don't know if I've ever said this on Entitled Opinions. It's been going on long enough that I don't want to repeat myself. But here in Palo Alto, you know, there's this restaurant called MacArthur Park. And it's
I know MacArthur.
Yeah. It's a big place. It used to be, I don't know if it's used to be a train station or some other big thing. But so it's two floors. When I first arrived here in the 80s, on the left-hand side, there were smokers. On the right-hand side, the non-smokers. And then they divided that the smokers had to go upstairs and the non-smokers downstairs. By 8:45, 9 p.m., downstairs was completely empty. Upstairs with the smokers at midnight, it was still going strong until
grooving.
Grooving because it was the cigarettes went with conversation and, you know, with a little bit of wine. And so this kind of sociality, which is now also alcohol serves us also a similar purpose. And now we are in an era these days where there's this very substantial reduction in the amount of drinking.
Yes.
And I think it's, clearly correlates with, it's not just me speaking here, sociologists are worried that with the significant decrease in the consumption of alcohol, there's this correlate decrease in socialization, conversation, and so forth. So in any case, that...
I have kids, and my son was telling me that when they go to a party, they don't even bother to dance.
Yeah.
They will stand at a corner and be bobbing their heads. I say, what? You go to a party and you don't dance? Like, what are you doing? He said, yeah. Now dancing is so old. They go, they stand in a corner and they'll just be bobbing. That's the most ridiculous anyway.
Well, it's just, one could serialize all these things that when you sum it all up, I mean, individually it doesn't seem all that, but when you sum it all up, it's part of the tragedy of a certain kind of disinheritance
malaise
of things.
It's malaise.
Yeah, malaise.
Social malaise.
And atomization.
Atomization, individuation, malaise, and even the skill, you know, because we just said the cigarette... It forced the skill to at least talk, because you have to ask. The skill of interacting beyond your immediate affinity group seems to have is no longer present, because your affinity groups are TikTok, Facebook, you know, that, and they just repeatedly affirm your own beliefs. And that's what is happening. I think that's a big social problem.
And it's not a form of speech. It's and as Hannah Arendt defined action as, or the vita activa, you know, the action is deeds and speech.
Deeds
so
and speech.
Speech is active in that sense.
I agree. Yeah.
So, Ato, before we conclude our show, I wanted to ask you, I know that you're writing a new book now, and that you mentioned to me that the movie Straw, which many people might not have seen, but I wanted to...
Tyler Perry.
If you wouldn't mind saying a few words about that movie, because there's something, we can't summarize the whole plot, but it does involve a character who, it's tragic, because it's almost Aristotelian that there's a moment of waking up to a realization of anagnorisis, where she didn't realize that her daughter is already dead, and wakes up, and so you get this rather important tragedy.
The new book, the title is Interdisciplinarity and Interpretation. Interdisciplinarity and Interpretation, and one of the chapters is on what I call disputes with vehemence.
With
vehemence in tragic history, and not to get into the weeds of it, in Tyler Perry's film Straw, The young woman who has a child is clearly a tragic character. Everything, there's a concatenation literally of unfortunate events that places her in an impossible position. And she goes to rob a bank. And she goes to rob a bank because she wants to cash her check of, I think it's $532. All kinds of things happen. It is only the police are called, there are TV cameras and so on. And she needs to cash the check because she needs to take meds to her daughter who is epileptic. So all that she's doing in the entire movie is to carry sustenance to her epileptic daughter. Only at the end of the movie does she discover that her daughter is already dead, that she died in the afternoon of the day that she's robbing the bank to get the money to go in. And so she's taken away. She's going to be detained. And so we wonder, and we don't know what happens. She's in the car, in the police van, being taken away. What we wonder is that her anagnorisis will entail a great amount of regret and grief, A, for the loss of her daughter, which it was in a way her fault, but it wasn't her fault because she couldn't have known that the delay and the causes of the delay are not in her hands. She doesn't control, but she will likely suffer a lot of guilt. She's lost her daughter. But also the futility of what she thought was her heroic act. Single-minded, maternal instincts. I need the money to go and help out my daughter. The futility of it. And so she's taken away. But the film is wonderful because it's, as you mentioned, it's very Aristotelian. There's hamartia in there, there's anagnorisis in there, there's plot. The concatenation of a series of unfortunate events and so on and so forth. And it's extremely sad because it's also about the lower dispossessed. Yeah. You know, African-American.
Completely disenfranchised.
Completely disenfranchised, dispossessed, and at the mercy of the world.
Ato Kwesen, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today on Entitled Opinions. I look forward to this new book that you're working on. And once it's out,
coming out in November.
In November, okay. Mm-hmm. So soon enough that, you know, this radio show might be still going. By then, we have you back to speak about
that would be a pleasure.
Disputes with vehemence.
Vehemence, yeah.
That's a great line. Mm-hmm. Thanks again. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Komm, wir gehen durch den Wind, komm, wir gehen ins Sand, komm. Komm, wir gehen, komm, wir laufen ins Sein. Wasserfeuer, 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 Wasserfe